AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to an Empire podcast special dedicated to Alien Earth, the brand new Disney Plus show that dropped its first two episodes today, Wednesday, August 13th, in case you're wondering what today's date was. Alien Earth is technically a prequel to Ridley Scott's classic Alien, of course, but it is very much expanding and evolving the ideas and themes that Ridders started playing with nearly 50 years ago, and which were picked up, of course, by the likes of James Cameron, David Fincher, Jean-Pierre Jeunet, and more across the decades, including Ridley himself. As you can tell from the title, this 8-part first season, the first they're hoping of several, I believe, somehow brings our old pal, the Xenomorph, to Earth a couple of years before the events of Alien, when a ship crash lands in the middle of a city, a ship carrying a terrifying cargo, one that some of the richest and most powerful people on the planet are very keen to get their hands on, for totally selfless reasons, of course. So, how does this all play out? How does this take place before Alien? What the hell is going on? Well, you're going to have to watch to find out, of course, but the answer is in ingenious ways. Because, yes, I know what you're thinking. An Alien TV show? Come on, give me a break. But Alien Earth is absolutely fantastic. We gave it 5 stars in our official Empire review, and much deserved they are too. This is a hugely ambitious series. Andor comparisons are much deserved, and it's playing with all kinds of weighty themes about humanity, life beyond humanity, our place in the cosmos, the ethics of experimentation, and much, much more, whilst also putting the willies right up us with some wonderful set pieces that remind you how scary the alien can truly be, something I think has been lost over the years. Oh, and here's another kicker. The alien may not be the most terrifying new arrival. So, in short, the show is a belter. But then, what did you expect from its creator and showrunner, Noah Hawley, the man behind the excellent Legion and Fargo? He's basically like the Lord and Miller of TV, taking premises that don't seem that promising on paper, but delivering something that's richer and deeper than you expected, and which sits alongside and augments the source material. So, right now, this special is comprised of 2 interviews that I conducted recently with Noah Hawley and 2 of the show's stars, Timothy Olyphant, who plays the mysterious android Kirsch, complete with a shock of white hair and white eyebrows and an inscrutable manner that means he's very much one to keep an eye on, and Sydney Chandler, who stars as Wendy, the next stage in human evolution, a hybrid with a genetically engineered body that houses the mind of a child. So first up, you're going to hear from Hawley. And while this isn't a spoiler pod, and we don't delve deep into the events of the first 2 episodes, in fact, I'd seen the first 6 before doing this interview, we do discuss some of the events that happen and some of the new creatures that Hawley is introducing to this world. I call them creepy Hawleys. They will haunt your nightmares, basically. So it might be best to listen to these interviews after you've seen the first 2 episodes, which is why this has gone up today, Wednesday, when those episodes drop on Disney+. But then if you're not bothered, then just dive on in as we talk in general terms about the show's genesis, the ideas that Hawley wants to explore, and his cast, including, as you're about to hear, seemingly half the cast of Ben Wheatley's Free Fire in the shape of Michael Smiley, Babu Cisse, and Enzo Salenti, all of whom are crew members aboard that crashed ship. But we also talk about the lengths that Sydney Chandler went to get Noah Hawley's attention for the role of Wendy. Either way, whatever you do, this is a fascinating conversation with a brilliant guy. So here it is, Noah Hawley talking about Alien Earth. Enjoy.
Noah Hawley, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you, sir?
I'm fair to Midland.
That's good. That's exactly where I am right now.
Yeah, it's better than a week ago and next week. You know, I'm good. Thank you for asking.
It's better than the alternative, is what
yes,
I always say.
Yes, it's true.
Absolutely. Before we get into Alien Earth, can I ask a question?
Yes.
Are you a fan of Ben Wheatley's Free Fire?
Ben, I am a fan of that movie, yes.
So it's not a coincidence then that three of the members of that film's cast are on the
Which
Machado.
Of the three? I know two of
so
them.
So Babu, Enzo, and Michael Smiley.
Oh, Enzo's in it also. Right, okay. Yeah, that wasn't deliberate. I do like that movie.
I thought you really liked that movie.
Yeah, I really like it. Well, I have seen it more than once. Let's just put it that way.
Good.
You know, it is a good excuse for a fun time. Certainly. No, that was just coincidence. Babu was the first cast and, you know, as a series regular. And then when it came time to populate the ship, I think I started with Michael, but it wasn't until after I'd cast them that I realized where I'd seen them all before, which was together.
There you go. Michael is great at sort of conveying that world weariness.
Yes.
There's a lovely sort of, you know, Harry Dean Stanton vibe going on.
Yeah, there was a moment where we were just shooting some B-roll and I asked him to tell a bedtime story and to Jamie, who plays his hapless engineer's assistant. And if you want a good story, ask an Irishman to tell anything, any story. So he was a delight.
So he was still going. He was like 20 minutes into
the story.
He's still
going now. Yeah, I think. Yeah.
Can you talk about casting with this? How did you approach it? What were you looking for in terms of putting together this ensemble?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of instinctual for me. You know, some people have synesthesia, right? Where it's like their senses get mixed up and they see colors and they hear, you know, that when they hear a sound, they see shapes, et cetera. You know, I just have a sense of casting where it's almost just the space the actor fills, right? Which feels like the character to me. And so certainly I have been surprised in auditions by actors' performances, but a lot of it is a sense of rightness. You know, oh yeah, this is that person. It's not really a competition. It's just looking for that person who feels right. And I do also, you know, like to incorporate characters who don't speak a lot sometimes. And so now you're looking for someone who can just hold the camera in a specific way.
Mm. I think you've described pretty much everyone in this show. Pretty much,
they all do hold the camera, but you know, I mean, it's the challenge here, right? I'm casting. You know, six adults to play children in adult bodies, and you know they're all written very specific characters with very different journeys, and you know, but it is a fascinating process to find those people, and I've had the experience more than once of writing a character and going, I don't know if I'm going to find the actor who can embody this, and then they're the first person that walks in the door. it's surprising.
I want to get on to Sydney and Wendy in a second, but you've worked with Timothy Olyphant before, of course. Very different character on Fargo. And I think he's deployed in this show in a very different way than we are used to seeing him.
Yeah.
He can sometimes straddle that line between white hat and black hat very, very nicely. But there's a really sinister side to Kirsch in this. I'm six episodes in and I'm dying to know what this dude's deal is. So what was, you know, was that something that you just saw on him when you were working with him in Fargo? You thought, this is my Kirsch.
Yeah. I mean, it's on some level, there's an unknowability. I mean, you know, in real life, he has such charm. He's a, you know, moderately handsome guy. And, you know, moves through life with a real ease and grace. But, you know, he's a rugged guy. And he tends to play a lot of alpha males, right? And he does that on both sides of the moral spectrum. You know, I think we were all introduced to him through some villainous characters that he played early on. And then obviously with Justified and I, too, gave him a role as a U.S. Marshal. I mean, he's kind of a type in a way. But when we were making Fargo season 4 together, back in 2020, I told him that I thought there was something for him in this. I was already thinking about him as I was thinking about this story. You know, there's something about the synthetic character of Ash, right, in the original film, played by Ian Holm, and then of course, you know, Bishop in the second film, and Michael Fassbender in the Prometheus films. You know, where there's a real Britishness to when you think about the synthetics in it, you know, there's a real Britishness to it. And what I liked about Timothy is how American he is in a way. It's just a very different prototype for a synthetic being. And I do think there's something to his just inherent likability, which is the opposite of the inherent dislikability on some level of the synthetics that are programmed into the film. So I think that tension is important, you know, especially if you're in a story that's looking at variations on you know, human immortality, whether it's Babu as a sort of a cyborg, for lack of a better word, who's a biological person with these mechanical enhancements, you know, to an AI, to a hybrid, you know, where we don't make it easy for the audience in terms of good and bad. I think they each carry the full moral spectrum. And I think if I've done my job right, then there are moments throughout the season where you're like, well, I know that I'm supposed to be rooting against Babu, but I feel like he's a man with a code and you know, there's something really likable about him. And then, you know, the same with Tim, where it's like, I don't trust this guy, but I also feel like he may be working an agenda in which the means justify the end. The ends justify the means, right? And that maybe in the end it's for the right. So I think, you know, when you do that, you create for the audience an opportunity to engage with the show outside of the show. Right, they're thinking about it after they watch it. They're talking about it after they watch it. That they got to watch the next one because the unanswered questions aren't just plot questions.
Absolutely, and the baggage that we bring to the show as well in terms of, as you said, you know, the audience's relationship with synthetics and the Alien franchise.
Yeah,
Bishop aside, I think
right
leads you to regard Kirsch with some suspicion.
Correct. Yeah,
which is going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But in terms of your wider approach to the show, though, you were talking about this 8 years ago. Your first conversations about the show happened 8 years ago.
Yeah,
was it Alien Earth even back then for you? Was this the broadly speaking what you ended up with, or how did it evolve?
Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, the conversation on some level the origins of this came in a request form. You know, we'd like to do Alien. We want it to take place on Earth. Great. That's where I'll start. You know, an Alien movie is always a trapped in a story, trapped in a spaceship, trapped in a prison. What if it wasn't, you know, claustrophobic in that same way? The Alien movies always, the pace of them always mimics the life cycle of the creature. So you start with slow dread and horror and build over it into action. Let's question all of those things, you know. And those were the early conversations. And you know, as a story creator, you want to have some constraints that, you know, that they're often helpful to know what the boundaries are. But for me, for whatever reason, in thinking about this tension in Ridley's movie between the monsters of our past and the AI monsters that we've created, and they're both trying to kill us, there was a really fascinating meditation on will humanity survive and or have we just created our own destruction from the greed that forced the corporation to go to the planet that found the creatures, et cetera. And so in thinking about that meditation on humanity and the next stage of humanity, and then obviously you have characters from the many different movies, like Winona Ryder's character and you know, is a more sympathetic synthetic being, etc. You know, came this idea for the hybrids, the transhuman, and then because my mind works the way it works, the next thought was, well, what if adult minds are too fixed. And so they start with children, and we're putting children's minds into adult bodies. And maybe that's because I'm raising children and I'm very invested in launching them. And
yeah.
I look at this adult world that we're all living in, and I'm worried for them. And so this idea of just taking a child and saying, you're an adult now, right? And how do you navigate the world? And, you know, that's very scary for me. And I thought a good place to start.
It's also a show that says, what's worse than billionaires? Trillionaires.
Right.
Which is, I guess, the way we're going.
They stop wearing shoes at that point.
They can afford shoes. No,
I mean, they can, but they stop.
Why do they stop?
They're like, you're all going to look at my feet now.
Absolutely. Yeah. I guess it all goes back to that line in Aliens. You don't see them fucking each other for a goddamn percentage.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, that's the thing is, you know, these creatures are much simpler. There's no ulterior motives, you know, and that's certainly something we explore in the show is the clarity of these creatures. They're not manipulating each other or lying to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a simplicity and honesty to them that I think if you're a child who's wrestling with, well, what even is this thing called human? And is if these are the adults, like, why would I want to be that?
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, that question suddenly makes the show ask questions that Alien has never asked before, which is, you know, are the creatures the worst thing in the story, or you know, by introducing these other creatures, I've taken the onus and the pressure off the xenomorph to be what it's always been. You know, and I hope that's the innovation that is really exciting for our fans.
You do this wonderful thing, again, without giving too much away, where you combine the traditional stuff that I think people will want to see, which is a xenomorph running amok and being, frankly, the sort of deadly killing machine we haven't seen for a while. And then you bring in these wonderful new twists, and you brought in these creatures that are terrifying on levels I can barely begin to articulate. How did you go about creating them? I mean, the eyeball monster is going to live long in people's nightmares.
Yeah. Well, some of it is just, you know, once I started laughing, I knew I'd hit a point where, oh, that's just the worst thing I've ever I've ever thought of. You know, it's a gift to the world to disturb them on that level.
I accept your gift.
You know, I think what was so profoundly disturbing about the xenomorph is that it's four monsters for the price of one.
Yeah.
And each stage of it, of its development, hits some core genetic revulsion,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it's the face hugger or the chest burster, you know, or the giant predator with two mouths. I mean, it just got worse and worse and worse. Right. And mm-hmm. so the key is, in introducing new creatures, is, you know, you have to have that where you're like, wait, how does it breed? I'm out on that, you know. So and just looking at you know, at my own and other people's, just, you know, what bypasses the rational brain, right? Mm-hmm. What are those irrational fears that we have? And you know, you think about kissing bugs in South America who come down in the middle of the night and you know, they're attracted to your lips. And you know, I mean, it's just, nobody wants any of that, right? So how do we tap into that, you know, and incorporate it into the show?
And then at the other end of the scale, you have Adrian Edmondson, who is a national treasure over here, as I'm sure
rightly so,
being just the most unspeakable prick, which is a delight to watch.
Yeah. Well, I've worked with a lot of comedic actors, and you know, it seems, you know, they often play a persona that when you meet them in real life, you know, I mean, Adrian, he's just a very dignified, you know, he's a lovely man. But he has this, you know, in his, you know, he put himself on tape for it, which I couldn't believe. And you know, there is a sort of like disdain, you know, a sort of an effete disdain that he brings to this to this character, but also a kind of implacability where he's a little unreadable in those yeah. ways. And, you know, I told him that there's a moment in The Young Ones that explains my entire career. It's the moment that he steps into the closet and ends up in Narnia, you know? And I was like, that is everything to me. There's no Legion without that moment. There's no Fargo without that. You know, there's the moment in which the show suddenly did something crazy and you thought a show can do that. Yep. A story can just suddenly end up in Narnia.
Yep.
Right. And the comedy that comes out of that incongruity, you know, anyway, he's a delight.
And that is amazing. This is an interesting sentence by my bottom guy. And so, you know, I would love to see him hit a xenomorph with a frying pan. I don't know whether that's something you can arrange, whether you can go back and reshoot stuff.
No, I'll work on it. There's always season two.
Anyway, from Narnia to Neverland, and, you know, I said we would talk about Sydney, who's terrific in this show,
yeah.
and Wendy, who is, you know, the center of the show in so many ways. You talked a little bit about where this idea for hybrids came from. Can you talk about where Wendy came from specifically and what Sydney brought to it, apart from, I don't know how she, I know she camped outside your house, essentially.
Yeah. No, she, you know, I was filming Fargo 5 while we were casting this, and she flew up to Calgary where we were filming and got herself the job. You know, she put herself on tape afterwards. But, you know, that passion matters, right? It's, yeah. you know, it's Bill Macy in Fargo. He auditioned in L.A., then he flew to New York and auditioned for them in New York. Like, he wouldn't take no for an answer, right? It matters. But, you know, the character of Wendy as a 12-year-old in an adult body, right? You think about Newt from yeah. James Cameron's film, who was a child with such dignity and poise. And then you think about Bill Paxton, who is this like adolescent, yeah. you know, game over man. And, you know, somewhere in there is where the Lost Boys came from. Yeah. And, you know, but if you go back and reread Peter Pan, it is a dark book, mm-hmm. you know, and there's something about Wendy who's basically kidnapped from her home with her younger siblings to come forced to be a mother. You know, yeah. to these boys, yeah. you know, with Peter watching, always watching, you know, making sure they don't grow up too much or any of it. And so, you know, that's the problem for her is like, they're put into adult bodies, but they're not allowed to be autonomous adults. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I needed an actress who had this power, you know, of identity, this power of just a drive of her personality, that she was going to be a noble, brave person who was going to embody the best qualities of humans, and then we were going to push her, you know, by making the adults around her, mm. you know, where she's like, well, if that's what it means to be an adult, I don't know that yeah. I want that.
You know, you direct the opening episode of this, and I wonder what it was like for you preparing to follow in the footsteps of Ridley and Jim Cameron and David Fincher and
yeah.
the amazing directors who worked in these movies.
Well, you know, I didn't go to school for any of this. I didn't go to school to learn to write novels. I didn't go to school to write screenplays. I learned how to direct on the job. Mm-hmm. You know, my mother is a writer. Her mother was a writer. My grandmother had an eighth grade education. My mother had a high school diploma. You know, these are all identities that we just have to claim and then earn,
yeah.
you know? And so, you know, I just, when I came to it, you can't think about the intimidating factors of, you know, of trying to make a Coen Brothers movie with the Coen Brothers watching you. Right. And, you know, what was good on some level here is that, you know, it's Ridley and Fincher and Cameron and Genet and, you yeah. know, it's all these directors. All their styles are different. All their approaches are different. So I'm less constrained. It's more just like, well, what is my aesthetic? What is my cinematic style of bringing it to this? And for me, it was like, well, we're going to make a 70s movie. because that will make it feel the most like Ridley's movie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how are we best creating the feelings in the audience that I want them to feel? That's the only reason I move the camera or use a lens or any of it. So
amazing. Yeah. On that note, I'm glad to go. Noah Hawley, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much indeed.
Thank you.
And that was Noah Hawley. And now let's go straight into the interview with Timothy Olyphant and Sydney Chandler, who were a lot of fun together. This one starts mid-sentence, as I was explaining to them that I had seen the first 6 episodes, but not, crucially, the last 2 episodes. And it all kicks off from that point on. And again, we try to steer clear of spoilers for anything beyond the first 2 episodes that are on Disney Plus right now. But again, if you want to wait until after you've seen those before you listen to this, it's entirely up to you. Either way, it's a fun interview. Enjoy.
I cannot wait to see the last 2 episodes. Tell me it doesn't fall off a cliff.
Cool.
How about that, Chandler?
Yeah, that's awesome, man.
This is all movie people.
Be careful, I'm trying to lure you into a trap. Yeah. The last 2 episodes fall off a cliff. Headline.
I have not seen the last 2 episodes.
Oh, really?
No, you've seen them.
I haven't seen them like fully done with
okay,
all of the
but
effects.
You've seen more than I've seen.
It's pretty awesome.
You've read the scripts, right? So you shot them.
So I read my scenes. I read my scenes. I thought my scenes were strong. But I will tell you that there are people I know and love and respect who have seen episode 8. And now apparently you as well are going to be one of those people. But those people talk about how amazing that episode is. Those people talk about that last episode as being the best episode of the season.
That is saying something.
I shouldn't do that. I'm overhyping it.
Well, maybe.
You know what? I hear it's pretty good.
The best episode of television ever? I think, can we say that? Sydney, can we say that?
That's, let's see if you say that after you watch it. Give us a call and let me know.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, you know, my hopes are high. My hopes are very, very high indeed. Let's talk about how you guys got involved with this, because I guess it was contrasting. I mean, you know, Kirshen and Wendy are studying contrast anyway, but you had contrasting ways into this. So Tim, Noah sidled up to you on the set of Fargo. I mentioned this
a few years ago. No, it's not how it worked.
That's what he told me, but okay.
He really did?
Yeah. He maybe didn't use the word sidled, but he certainly said he mentioned it to you on Fargo.
Our memory today.
Okay.
Well, this is interesting. I remember talking to him over the years, and it's not that it's very meaningful to me that, you know, we've had conversations over the years since we've met about possible things.
Yeah.
And so he may have sidled up to me on the set of Fargo but to talk about this, but I recall him talking about something more abstract. Maybe I didn't know it was this. You know, he's very man a few words kind of guy sometimes.
Okay.
At least he is with me. I don't think he likes talking to me. And he might have just said, I think I have something for you.
Something in space.
He said, I think I have something. I might have something for you.
And that's it. And then you went.
I said, you send me a call sheet and I'll show up.
Four years later, you show up.
And he said,
who am I playing?
Don't write any checks you can't cash. And I said, no. Try me. And here I am. You know what I'm saying? Here I am. What's
it
your
all
story?
Out.
Yeah, Sydney. So you sought Noah out.
Yes. Opposite. Yeah. I read
Did
the
first. Did you sidle up to him or was it just?
I flew right over to Canada. And for some reason, he said yes to letting me, you know, take him to dinner and talk Alien.
Doesn't work with every director, right?
I feel like it shouldn't have worked.
Uh-huh.
I feel like I don't know why he said yes.
Who paid for dinner?
Don't know how I'm here.
You did?
I did. Yeah.
It's a cool move.
My dad would have killed me if I didn't.
Oh.
Yeah.
Nice.
But I also thought it was, you know, I won't give him all the credit.
Did Noah
at
least.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't give him. You take that. Take that.
Did Noah at least leave the tip or did you take out the tip as well?
I don't recall.
Oh my God.
No, we talked for it's like 3 or 4 hours. About the script, but also just both of our shared love of sci-fi, which was really fun. And then I got back home, did an audition process really, really fast. So it was a lot of impulse and instinct and memorizing while driving, getting back to where I'm going to tape. And then I got, you know, radio silence for, it feels like years. And then Noah called me and he said, I got the part. And then he, a few days later, invited me over to his place to sit, chat, and meet his wonderful family. Uh-huh. And he lived 5 minutes away from me, walking. Which was, but Canada was awesome.
That's good. I'm glad.
Yeah. But yeah, I used to run by his house, every day.
Well, hey, if you'd shown up at his house just 5 minutes away, he might not have seen it as a grand gesture. He might not have seen that you really wanted the part.
Precisely. There was a lot of drama to it.
Absolutely.
Flying to Canada.
Yeah.
So I've always wanted to go. It's a nice, 24 hours.
Whereabouts in Canada was it? Calgary? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I think so.
Look at you.
Yeah.
Flying to Canada, paying for dinner and auditioning.
Girl's playing
hard to get.
I'm trying.
Sending the big signals. Way to keep them guessing, Chandler.
Have you ever pursued a director like that, Tim? Have you ever lived within the walls of a director's house?
Something tells me I would have had a better career had I done that. But I was too busy being dumb.
So how much did you know about the role going into this? So you're doing this grand gesture. You're flying to Calgary. So you must have known a lot about Wendy, or how much of it was a Hail Mary pass?
I had the first three scripts, okay. And we talked a little bit about where the story would go.
But not episode 8, the greatest episode of TV ever.
I did not say that.
Well, someone
said it. It is really cool. So I'm curious.
It's what people say.
It's what
I've heard tell.
I've heard tell.
That it's on the pretty awesome.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've got the first three scripts.
Yes.
At this point.
Yeah. And I really just gravitated to just the feeling of her. There was something in my gut that really, really wanted to tackle a character like that.
Yeah.
And the relationship with Wendy and having her brother, Joe, played by Alex, just having a sibling relationship be the essence of the love in a story instead of a romance. You don't see a lot of sibling relationships.
No.
And that was really, really, really enjoyable to jump into.
And she's fascinating, Wendy. She's a bit of an open book in a way. She's absorbing so much information about the world. Kirsch, on the other hand, what is this dude's deal? Because I've seen 6 episodes and I am fascinated to know what's going on inside
what
that big brain of his.
What is this dude's deal?
What is that something you asked yourself day one? First of all, who am I playing? I really like to know.
I don't ask that question. I just say, what are my lines? Okay. It's boiled down to what are my lines?
Which are Lynn held up
I
the cue cards around
and
the set.
Where do I stand?
Okay. So you just happened to show up with your hair and your eyebrows like that? And
no,
just...
we had some chit chats over the phone, maybe even in person.
Uh-huh.
We didn't talk about the show that much. But I love talking to Noah. I love picking that guy's brain, anytime you're around someone like Noah, you just, try to squeeze as much juice out of there as you can. Mm-hmm. But as far as the gig's concerned, I mean, he may say differently. I remember him saying he had something in mind. I remember him telling me about the role more or less.
Mm-hmm.
I think I knew what he was looking for. We'd worked before. So I think he had a sense of I feel like this, here's what you do really well, and that's how this could maybe help, this could help,
What specifically did he say that you did well that fed into Kirsch?
Acting.
Just the power of acting.
I don't have any other skills, so I think
it was acting. You do show up very present, and you create a really, really fun, safe space to work, I will say.
You
don't just memorize lines. But at the same time, you do show up very, very open to everything that's happening, which I pocketed. Yeah. Thank you for that.
I appreciate you saying so.
Yeah.
Look, Noah makes the job really easy.
Yeah.
He makes the job really easy. And when something's really well written, it just gives you a lot of room. Mm-hmm. So anytime you show up on set and with the confidence of knowing if you just say the lines, you're still going to have a pretty good scene.
Mm-hmm.
It just gives you so much freedom. So, you're looking, then after that, my job is to, to look for what's maybe not there on the page, mm-hmm. that if you put there, would just add a little something, contradict what's on the page is always mm-hmm. fun. Anytime I feel like I can, find the contradiction, that's a fun place to start.
Because literally the title card of the show, the first thing we see is this introduction to the idea that there's three different mm-hmm. types of mm-hmm. post-human, I guess, in this quest for immortality. And Kirsch is one type, the synth, and Wendy is a different type. Mm-hmm. And they both strike me as really, really interesting. Kirsch is, and I don't know whether this was something that you brought to it from day one, just seems faintly appalled by everyone around him.
Look, I know
there's a disdain going on.
I know Noah's writing about something, it appears, and one of those things seems to be our distrust of AI. Yep. And I knew that that's embodied in this role. Mm-hmm. And absolutely. So, it seems like there lies the job, right? Is to find the things that keep the audience off balance. Mm-hmm. To some degree, you look for that opportunity to play that just within the scene, just mm-hmm. when we're working, to find the little ways you can just see where you can throw some curveballs. Mm-hmm. And it's really easy with this cast. They're all really good. You can throw anything you want and it comes back at you, and it's really fun.
Absolutely. And suddenly, of course, Wendy is a hybrid.
Yes,
which is more than just a golf club. It is
something. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Well, she might be a golf club as well. I don't know. I presume Sydney can hit the ball.
Season 2.
500, 600 yards.
Yeah. No. Hell of a golfer.
Hell of
We're going to get into that.
What a swing.
That's a story.
Yeah, listen, yeah. I'm not saying that's what episode 8, where it goes. I'm just saying you might be onto something.
Oh, my God.
Foreshadowing.
All right. People love sports.
Golf. Brought to you by.
What do people love? They love aliens and they love sports. Put the two together.
Yeah. We
haven't
seen that one.
Episode 8.
We haven't seen that one.
Alien.
When Noah said he was going to make it his own, people didn't realize.
There you have it.
I mean, it's such an interesting concept, Sydney. Did you have, what sort of discussions did you have with Noah about playing this character, but also how possible is it? And, to implant consciousness from one person into a different shell, a different body.
Yeah, well, I haven't experienced it personally.
Not yet.
Yeah.
Not yet.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows if that will become, a thing one day, which is wild. Mm-hmm.
I heard Peter Thiel talking about it just 2 weeks ago.
I'm sorry, this is so random. I wrote in a Waymo. One of those self-driving cars a few days ago. And my mind is still shattered.
Wow.
Yeah. So the future is here.
You've got some surprises coming. That is, my understanding, that's the tip of an iceberg there.
I am a dinosaur. Yeah. I live under a rock. I drove in a Waymo.
Were you terrified? Because I'd be terrified.
I was. Yeah, it speaks to you.
No,
it says,
speaks to
I know this
Peter
is
Thiel
strange,
was talking about
but...
people's putting people's brains in synthetic bodies. Just
never
like
mind. This is a self-driving car.
Yeah, keep going back to the self-driving car.
I was in a Waymo.
No, I understand. Yeah, you stay to your story. I'm sorry, I'm interrupting your story. Keep going.
What was your question?
You and a Waymo.
I have no idea what my question was, but I'm just fascinated by the self-driving car. This is
scary. Yeah. And there's also
were you a fan?
It freaked me out, and I didn't like how it excited me because I just thought, oh my gosh, humanity is so insanely smart to be able to make something like this.
Yes.
There's also a little walking robot around Austin, Texas. Mm-hmm. The city's used for a lot of prototypes. So Waymo was first brought to Austin. If you look it up, little robot walking in Austin in cowboy hat, I'm not making that up.
I will do it immediately once I get out of here.
He's just wandering around. It's bizarre.
Interesting.
It is bizarre.
So are you both optimistic or pessimistic about the future of humanity? Do you think we're sowing the seeds of our own downfall with these Waymos?
Lord knows I'm rooting for us.
Yeah.
But I do feel the experience, I feel like the thing with the Waymo is not just the experience of driving the car and the amazing of it all, that there's not a person involved. It's how much you enjoy it. That it's like,
have you done it? Have you had the?
You're like, scary. I can't believe I really like that, that yes. experience.
You're like,
and then you're like,
I
oh,
hate it.
Oh
and
no!
Yeah, it's automatically addicting. Which is scary.
Now when it comes up on your phone, you go, no, I don't want people anymore.
I think that is the universal underneath it all is that people realize, oh, it's a really nice drive, and they realize, oh, sometimes it's scary to admit that. Not being around a person could be that enjoyable.
Yeah.
Being around.
Yeah.
It's not a good sign.
No.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Guys, I've got to let you go, but I just want to ask very, very quickly. Mm. There are, as well as the classic alien, classic xenomorph in this, there are some terrifying new creatures that Noah's come up with from the dark recesses of his brain somewhere. the eyeball creature, what the fuck? I think that's the full name of the creature.
That's its name.
That's its name. Is that the one that sticks in your brain as well? Maybe literally, I don't know.
I think the scariest creature of all is Sam Blanken. Really terrifying. Specifically, the right foot.
And you know she's
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who are the real monsters? Huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's man.
Yep.
It's man.
Wiggles the toes.
That being said, that little guy's special. I mean, so far he's an early favorite. I know there's still a lot to discover.
Yeah.
You know, the season, even at the end of the season, there's much to discover.
Yes.
Okay.
But right now, he's definitely a front runner.
Yeah.
In episode 8, which...
Sam and then Image.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. I think in that order.
And the sheep, just the whole storyline of Victoria the sheep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Up there.
Yeah.
Up there. That trifecta. Nightmares.
Yeah. Extraordinary. I cannot wait for the golf tournament that concludes episode 8.
It's going to be fantastic.
Victoria the sheep and Kirsch and Sydney. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. All in driverless cars. Fantastic. Guys, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Cheers.
Well, that was Timothy Oliphant and Sydney Chandler. A lot of fun together. And that is it for this Alien Earth special. Hope you guys enjoyed it. We're hoping to do spoiler specials for Alien Earth over on our subscription feed. If you haven't already subscribed to our spoiler specials, my God, what are you waiting for? You're missing out. It's incredible. empire.supportingcast.fm, £3.49 a month for several new spoiler specials every single month and access to our archive of over 400 spoiler specials, including interviews with some of the biggest and best filmmakers on the planet. So we're not sure yet if we're going to be doing weekly episodes for Alien Earth. It is certainly a show that warrants weekly discussion, but we shall see. We might just top and tail it. But let us know what you would like. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the show. I hope you enjoy those specials. I hope you've enjoyed this. Anyway, that's enough for me. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.